Good afternoon, everybody. The next topic is a serious matter, a strong, intangible value for any organizer. It's about security at future major events. The crowd disaster at the Love Parade in Duisburg, the bomb attack at the Boston Marathon, or the mass shooting at the Harvest concert in Las Vegas. How can security not be a top topic? The threats to the safety and security of major events are global, complex, and challenging. Issues such as venue security, crowd management, counter-terrorism, and not to forget cyber attacks, confront event organizers on a daily basis. Another aspect, of course, are the costs associated to this. They are huge and an often unpredictable cost factor for event organizer and host city. Host cities for large events may pull out of a candidature phase because of not affording costs or not finding the right strategy to address, leaving the citizens and taxpayers sometimes with no answer to their questions. Planning security for a major event requires a customized approach that considers effective security measures against a realistic assessment of likely threats to the event. While responsibility for threats assessment and security planning lies with the organizer of the venues, the police and the local authorities must be involved as key partners. Of course, organizers have a duty of care to spectators, athletes, officials, and staff to put in place measures and plan to deliver event security to the most appropriate level. I'm pleased to have here on stage experts with me from different fields to discuss key questions about security. They all have experience to share with you, so I'm looking forward to our panel. I'd like to introduce briefly the panelists. You see the names and functions on the screen, so I'll give you some background information maybe just to extend. I start with Patrick on the right side. Patrick has been involved in sports since the age of 7, you told me, and I even know that there has been a little experience with the President Bach at the time at fencing. You may tell later on about that. He has been involved in risk management processes for 14 Olympic Games, 3 FIFA World Cups, and is now associated to a strong European insurance broker. I have Ken in the middle. Ken was a strategic lead and author or co-author of the recently published 6th edition of the Guide to Safety and Sports Ground, which is also called the Bible of Sports Grounds Safety Practitioners Around the World. Maybe we learn more about that later on. And last but not least, Billy. Billy is responsible for managing one of the most significant public sports services in the UK. Billy provides leadership across key initiatives in support of Glasgow's sport and physical activity priorities. This is the panel, and I'll start with some questions addressed to them right now. Maybe start with Billy first. We were talking before about Glasgow 14 and the Commonwealth Games and the European Championships. And can you tell us a little bit about the security strategy and the difference between these two major events?
Thanks, Daniel. If you'd been a visitor to Glasgow for both those events, 2014 and 2018, you would have immediately been conscious of a very different atmosphere in the city. At 2014 for the Commonwealth Games, we had a really significant physical security overlay, kind of referred to only half jokingly as a kind of ring of steel around key venues. That ring of steel, that approach to security, that focus on physical security measures was not just expensive, and I'll come back to that, but was actually quite disruptive, and I mean disruptive in a negative sense. Disruptive for business in the city, business continuity, disruptive for local communities who lived near some of the key competition venues. Streets had fences constructed down the middle, etc. It was also disruptive for the customer journey. People attending events had to go through quite a tortuous journey before they finally got to their seats in the field of play. But it was also expensive. And to give you an indication, the security budget for the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2014 was roughly equivalent to the entire budget for the European Championships in 2018. So that gives you an idea of the scale. So there was a very different approach in 2018, much lighter touch. And whilst there was less physical overlay, I would argue that there was no less security. So how were we able to adopt a different approach? And I think that was because we approached security, the 2018 team in partnership with Police Scotland, approached security conceptually in a different way. Security was, it was event-led. What do I mean by that? It was delivered and governed as an integral part of event delivery. It wasn't separate, so the budget was held within the event, it was managed from within the event, and it was delivered within the event. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignored any advice from the security services or from the police. Quite the contrary. We worked in partnership with them, and they were embedded in the event delivery structure. And in fact, every recommendation that came from Police Scotland was implemented. And that enabled us to deliver a very successful event with a very different feel, very different atmosphere in the city, with a much reduced budget that allowed us to focus on different aspects of event delivery. It meant that every decision around security was taken as part of an integrated approach to the overall event. Nothing butted up against anything else. It was all a holistic approach. And I think there's a lesson there, not just for us in Glasgow, but a lesson for anyone else approaching multi-sport or mega events. We were certainly very pleased with that. I don't know if there's anyone from Police Scotland here, but I know from debriefs that the team have carried out with Police Scotland, they also felt from their point of view, from their agenda, that was a really positive experience from their point of view.
Thank you, Billy, for telling us the difference. This leads me to Ken, actually, for a question also about security on sports grounds, because we all know there are internal areas to sports ground and external areas. And can you tell us how significant this consideration of the external areas of a sports ground in running a safety event?
Yeah, I think the consideration of external areas is hugely significant now. No longer can we plan for events and the outside space in isolation. They need to look at the sum of all of the parts in the planning of this. And I think everyone's aware that we live in a completely different environment now when we are planning to host safe and secure events. Certainly, and thank you, Daniel, for the plug for the new edition of the Green Guide, which is currently out. When we did the fifth edition in 2008, the risks arising from things such as terrorist activity were very slight. But we've seen clearly in recent years, the attack on Stade de France in November 2015, the Manchester Arena attack last year, the need to understand how that external environment works. So very much in the sixth edition of the Green Guide, we've included areas that look at what we call this Zone X. And Zone X, for those of you that worked on the London 2012 Olympics, is an extension of what we were calling then the last mile. So it's understanding how this area works. And to do that, we see there are three key areas that need to be considered. And they actually all follow neatly within the Council of Europe Convention. So the three drivers for us are clearly around security, what the impact of any additional security overlay could be, and that could be the introduction of hostile vehicle mitigation, it could be the impact and need for additional or higher levels of screening. But that then impacts upon the safety element, because the safety element of introducing this additional overlay could potentially mean that you don't get everyone in before the event. What is the impact on that with an audience that is going out to the world in terms of its broadcast? So it's understanding what the, if you like, the unintended consequences could be of introducing that form of security. But the impact on safety could be something as simple as just impacting upon the carefully designed movement patterns of people around the outside of the building. But I keep coming back to the third point, which for me, as a fan of all sports, but predominantly football, and that is around engaging with the spectator. We've heard a couple of comments in the previous panel session about getting people to come early. Well, to do that, we need to give them something to do. We can't just ask people to turn up early because there are high levels of screening or searching without giving them the hook that gets them there early. And whether it be alcohol, whether it be entertainment, there needs to be something to provide that. Because particularly in my particular background, which is football, football fans are creatures of habit. They are used to turning up 15 minutes before the start and expect to get in before the activity commences. That's no longer going to happen for matches where there is a level of security attached to it. We need to develop that line of thought in the same way that we all, when attending or turning up at an airport now, expect to turn up 2 hours before or we don't get on. So there's a big education thing around that. But it comes back to the third point, which again follows, as I said, the Council of Europe Convention, and that's the customer service bit. Because again, the recurring theme of the sessions I've heard this morning is, you know, we live in a world of safety and security, but the customer's at the heart of it all. And the presentation on Formula One and their shift from sport to the entertainment industry is a true concept. The last thing that we want to do through all of this additional overlay of safety and security is to create an environment where me and my family and you and your family feel this isn't the place we need to be. So it's about the delicate equilibrium between safety, security and customer service. And we really do need to get that right.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. We take a little other perspective now, asking Patrick, with your experience in advising large organizing bodies, and in the pre-planning phase of an event, it's about gathering information and intelligence for an organizing body. They conduct risk, vulnerability, and threat analysis. What is the main evolution you've experienced over the last years in this respect?
Yes, in reality, and just to go back to the beginning of your speech, I did 18 Olympics in a row, but the four first, I was a referee in fencing, and it's the reason why I met very often Thomas Bach, and I was a referee of his gold medal. And to answer to your question, I think if I summarize in three words, I can say is from legal to security. When I began as a risk manager for Albertville in 1992, it was my first game, so I began to work in 1988 for Albertville. And the main part of my job was to analyze the different contracts signed by the organizing committee. And perhaps you don't know, but they signed an incredible number of contracts. I remember that in Atlanta in 1986, they signed 17,000 contracts. You imagine the job to analyze all these contracts to be sure that the contracts are correctly written, only on the standpoint of liability, and how to share this responsibility between the local organizing committee and the subcontractor or the contractor. This was a job we did at the very beginning, and now we are doing a sort of operational risk analysis. The majority of the risk we work on are 50% or 55% of them are linked with security problems. So it's totally new, when I say new, since 15 years now, or perhaps a little more. At the beginning, we were just on working on legal problems, and now we are more and more working on security. And perhaps I can say in the future, we will work only on security. It's certainly one of the major problems of the future. I just want to give you a small idea. What is that? It's a telephone. No, it's not a telephone. It's a weapon. Perhaps you are surprised, but when you are a football player, a football referee, and if you make a mistake during your match, you have a risk that one person inside the stadium uses his telephone just to give the information to 200, 300, 400 people who will arrive around the stadium. And when the referee wants to go out, he will have a very warm welcome, if I can say that. So this is totally new. In 1995, you do not have this tool. So we have to think about all these particular and new tools, which are very, very important for us in terms of technology, but also very, very dangerous.
Thank you, Patrick, for this insight. Well, what will happen in the next 10 years, no? If you see the development of mobile phones now, and if you think about the perspective in 10 years, who knows what will happen. Billy, coming back to what you said before, what impact do the approaches of previous events have on the next host city? I expect the London 12 Olympics has a massive impact on the planning of Glasgow 14. However, 18, there seemed to be a deviation from the previous high level of personnel and overlay. Can you explain that a bit?
I think we all of us in the sector, continually evolve best practice. So, whether it's, learning the lessons from 2012 into 2014 or from 2014 into 2018, I think all of us in the industry are actually really rather good at learning the lessons, good and bad, from one event to the other. And certainly in Glasgow, we as a matter of policy, go through kind of structured debriefs and learn lessons, not just from our own events, but from others. And when I say good and bad, I mean just that. So you're right that there was a big difference, talking about security, there was a big difference between, as I've said, between 2018 and 2014. That's because we learned lessons from 2014 about what worked and what didn't work. And there was, I suppose, the kind of watchwords were about what was appropriate and what was proportionate. We were able to, because of our approach, because we'd integrated it, because we embedded it in the event, we were able to develop our own event risk assessment, threat level assessment for the event. So whilst the national threat level assessment in terms of counterterrorism was at severe at the time, working in partnership with the security services, we were able to create an event threat level of moderate. In other words, it was an intelligence-led approach as opposed to a focus on, as I said earlier, a kind of physical infrastructure-led approach. And that is learning lessons from the previous events, the previous iterations. And certainly we learn lessons from 2014. So it's that constant evolution, whether it's on security or any other aspect of event delivery. I think that's what allowed us to develop our approach. And there's a number of key principles, I think, which we have learned. One is about embedding and embedding early, about an event-led approach. I suppose these are the key principles that I think we learned.
Thank you, Billy. My background is infrastructure and technology, so I have a question actually to Ken, which leads into the technology sector. Today, security technology is impressive and more advanced. For example, there is facial recognition. There is license plate reading, gunshot detection equipment available, also advanced access control and ticketing technology contribute. How can an organizer now benefit from all these capabilities and technologies?
I think the kind of the watchword is caution. And I think there is a bewildering array of tools and equipment and technologies that are out there now, almost of Steven Spielberg type proportions. And I think the key is to beware of being sold something that you may or may not necessarily need. So the guide, the green guide, is only produced every 10 years. Clearly, we can't keep up to date with technology, because for all it was launched on the 30th of last month, it would already be out of date if we tried to keep up in touch with smart technology. So the key bit is to point people in directions, but it's all around, I guess, first of all, any event organizer needs to identify what the risk is, and importantly, what the risk appetite is for the particular venue. Because if anybody has the notion that they will go for complete security, then I've yet to see it. There will be a risk attached to every event that takes place, and the only safe event or the only safe stadium I've ever seen is a stadium that's empty. And clearly, we don't want that. So it's understanding what the level of risk is that is proportionate and what that level of risk appetite is for the organizing event. So in saying all of that, it's we clearly want to enjoy safe events. I was on a Council of Europe trip last week looking at the palm reading recognition, which I thought was quite useful. I probably get calls like this every couple of weeks to come and have a look at some new technology, which for me, as a non-tech person, always amazes me. Then I speak to you guys who are in the industry, oh, that was done last week or that was done last year. So the key bit for me is about understanding it. But the problem that we've often had in sporting events is we always know how many people are inside the arena. We don't always know who it is that's in. So any technology that helps to identify the individual then helps with lots of issues about ticket resales, counterfeiting, and the rest of it. So I'm quite keen on looking and understanding how that technology can work with us. So for me, the whilst technology is good, I think we need to embrace it, we need to understand it. I keep coming back to the human element in all of this, and the human element is the biggest asset and the most valuable asset is generally the staff that are working at these events. And I'm sure that in many cases we don't employ them to their maximum capability through maybe not engaging with them, not keeping them fully informed. So for me it's about, you know, yes, look at the level of technology that's appropriate to your event. Don't be bewildered by the vast array that's out there. But, you know, in terms of looking for a safe solution, start closer to home and looking at the benefits you get from vigilant staff.
Thank you, Ken. I don't want to put you in a panic mode, but I would like Patrick maybe to tell us a little bit about how technology, if it's not used to secure security and safety, how it could be misused on different events. I mean, I know you shared some information about, you know, what the scenarios are, organizers are or need to work through. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what intention of maybe people are on the other sector?
Yes, can I speak until next Friday?
No, just
2 minutes.
Yes.
Well, it's a very difficult question because, as you know, we have good people and bad people, and the bad people are able to transform everything in bad things. It means that you talk about cyber at the beginning. Cyber does not exist if we do not use any computer. Well, we have no problem. So you have to imagine that you can block an hospital totally just using your computer. If you are a bad guy, you can block the hospital by turning off the electricity of the hospital. It's a game that some people try to play in the United States very recently, 2 or 3 months ago. So without cyber, we have not this risk. And because of the cyber development, we have now cyber criminality. Another example, and I know that there is some specialist in the room, is the drones. So drones is fantastic to have images, to have a lot of very interesting things. But drones could be also an incredible weapon, such as what happened with Maduro 1 month ago or something like that. But in a stadium, you cannot imagine what you can do with a drone. I know that it's forbidden to go with a drone inside a stadium, and the control, the access control has an important mission to be sure that no one drone will be inside the stadium without an official authorization. Nevertheless, if you have several party of this drone, you can go in a stadium if you have several people, and if you are really badly if you have a bad mind. So with that, you can kill people, you can, a lot of people, you can. I will not give you any recipe in order to help you to kill people, but I can tell you with a drone, you can kill in a closed stadium, indoor stadium, you can kill 2,000 or 3,000 people in less than 2 minutes. In particular, if you want to die, to suicide yourself, so it's totally, as I say before, it's totally new, it's very dangerous, and so we cannot refuse the technology. We have to go with the technology, but we also, when we organize sport events, we also have to live with to manage our life with the technology, and sometimes it's really very difficult.
Thank you. Well, that's an awful scenario. So. When we talk about a venue or a closed venue, this is one thing. But you know, talking about fan zones or new experience, I mean, that must be a nightmare. Can you tell us a little bit about that aspect?
Yes, I am a fan of a fan zone as a fan, but as a risk manager, for me, it's a nightmare. it's fantastic to be able to have the smell of the sport events. When you have no money, for example, you cannot go in the stadium because the price of the tickets is several hundred dollars. But you can have the smell, you can have the atmosphere of the match going to a fan zone. Fantastic. Well, on one side. On the other side, the fan zone are free of charge. This is the basis of the fan zone. This is perfect. But you can go, anybody can go in the fan zone. So you have an access control. Yes, this is clear, but it's not enough. In particular, when you have 60, 50, 100,000 people in the fan zone, it could be really very, very dangerous also. So if you take the example of Buenos Aires, where we have the Youth Olympic Games very recently, all the access were free of charge. So it was like a huge fan zone. The entire city of Buenos Aires was a sort of fan zone. But what they did, and it's a very good solution in my opinion, they obliged every people who want to go to a fan zone or to a stadium to go on internet, to give his name, his first name, and so on, his address, and also his credit card number, not to pay anything, or perhaps 10 cents, so a stupid amount of money, just to be certain that the person has an address, has also a number of a credit card number. So it's not 100% of security, but it's a very good element of security. And when you when you want to go to a fan zone, in my opinion, it's more or less compulsory to have this type of access control. You have to go to internet to say, I will go tomorrow to this fan zone. So you pay 10 cents, more or less nothing, but you need to have a credit card. And it is, for me, it's a very good solution in order to protect the people who are in the fan zone. If you have a total free access, really, you put the people, you put the spectator in the fan zone in a very dangerous situation.
Thank you. Maybe you want to expand right on that?
Well, of course, I won't disagree with you, Patrick. All I would say, however, is that in Glasgow, and I think it was mentioned earlier in one of the other sessions, we have been, without sounding boastful, I think we've been quite successful in Glasgow of weaving around events a wider cultural and kind of community engagement festival in the city to create a much wider event. And a key part of that strategy, which we saw most recently, I suppose, in the summer during the European Championships, is a series of, we wouldn't have called them fan zones, but a series of free access festivals, whether it was in George Square or in Glasgow Green or indeed in other parts of the city. That's absolutely integral to our approach. And what is that about? Well, it's about ensuring that really everyone gets the opportunity to feel part of the event experience. It's about widening the benefits as far as we can. It's about everyone gets access to, you know, opportunities around physical activity, opportunities around cultural engagement. It's about bringing into engagement those people who are furthest from engagement, furthest from physical activity, etc. So we actually see it as part of the raison d'etre of us actually having these major events. We feel that it's important that it's free. We feel that it's important that people can be spontaneous, can actually just decide when they get up in the morning that they're going to come down, that they're going to bring their kids, that they're going to kind of go down to Glasgow Green and engage in the activities. So it's not that I disagree, but I think there is a conversation to be had about balancing the risks that are associated with that kind of activity with what we would regard as the significant benefits that you derive from widening participation and widening engagement that these kinds of activities generate.
Can I just come in on that? I kind of sit between the two areas here. That fan zones, invariably, they are here to stay. They attract, or they come from every big event, whether it be IOC, whether it be FIFA, whether it be UEFA. And they've got a good place to play for all the reasons that Billy said. I think the key is that these events are often bigger than the attraction that brings the event to that particular country. So the crowds that they get are much larger. But in terms of preparedness and target hardening, they can be seen in some cases to be a softer option than the target hardened venue. So I think clearly there needs to be some work around that. And I go back to 2016, I was at the Euros, I was actually in the fan zone under the Eiffel Tower. On the night, there was a very, very loud explosion. And it was a firework, but no one was to know that at the time. And there was a stampede of people running to get away from it. And it was a scary experience. But I think the learning from me for that, and there were people injured as a result of that, the learning from me was that is that we need to have the, not necessarily the same levels of application that we've got for sports grounds, but there needs to be a, if you like, a wider recognition of the risks. Because if I was the wanton terrorist looking to create mayhem, then, you know, do I tackle a venue that's target hardened and pretty secure, or do I look for another large crowded place which could be a fan zone or the people outside of that? And often you find, you know, as we found in the fan zones we've been involved in, lots of the legal obligations around the venue don't apply to the fan zone. So you could get, for instance, from my football background, people who've got banning orders that can't get into a football ground anyway can legally get into a fan zone and cause mayhem. So what we're looking to do in future is that we'll be looking to develop on the back of the Green Guide some guidance that will help tournament organisers around the planning and the delivery of a fan zone.
Thank you, Ken. I have 1 minute left, I heard, but it's important to have some question maybe from the audience. I'm sure you picked up a few things here. Yes, can somebody bring a mic?
Hello. are we too soft on people, particularly in wheelchairs? And is there a disconnect between the Equality Act and keeping non-wheelchair-bound or other mobility impairments safe whilst not invading the privacy or affecting the disability in any way?
Ken, would you like to answer that?
Clearly, it's a very important point. And those of you that follow the press, the particular criticisms that have come into sporting venues, particularly football in the UK, around their lack of access or the lack of the creation of an accessible environment, are rightly founded. We produced a guidance document called the Accessible Stadia Guide about 15 years ago now. We did plan to include various strands of that document within the latest sixth edition of the Green Guide. But because the guide is a guide to safety at sports grounds, we feel that to give correct and deserved recognition and status to a document, it needs to stand on its own. So the commitment I have given to my board is that on completion of the Green Guide, which is out now, we will then look to sit down with probably Department for pensions, for work and pensions, and with the EHRC to look at rewriting the Accessible Stadia Guidance document, which I've got to admit, almost embarrassingly, is severely outdated.
Thank you, Ken. I hope you got an answer on your question. I have time just for one last question.
Danny from BR90, we're a fan engagement agency, so the area of the talk was good for us to hear. To sort of speak about fan zone in terms of knowing who's in the fan zone, Patrick, you mentioned ticketing the fan zone in some way. I would again add to that and say if an event or something coming to a city wants to have a proper strategy around fan engagement, and then they should know who's in their fan zone anyway through other means, staff, etc., collecting data. And then on that, you spoke about security staff as well. The question I want to ask is, do you think there's a need now, as we move into different times, of integrating engagement staff that are there to meet, greet, and make sure fans have a good time with security staff to then have a knowledge base of crossing those two areas together?
Wants to give a quick answer to that?
Yeah, very important point. And it's this bit about understanding once and for all that, you know, sporting fans come from lots of different backgrounds. So there's lots of different demographic to whoever is coming to a sporting event. But the first thing that we all want to see is a warm welcome. So it's this bit about, you know, the human behavioural bit that we're spending a lot of time understanding now, that again, sadly, perhaps in years gone by, we didn't. Identifying that the need and the wishes of different groups are different. So whether it be the ultra group or whether it be a family group, we need to identify what their demand is, and hopefully we can try to accommodate it. But you're quite right. It's this whole business around, you know, the engagement. It's the warmth of the welcome. And it's, I think, as I said in one of the previous questions, it's about, you know, remember that this is an event where people are coming along to enjoy themselves. They don't want to be faced by lines of Alsatian dogs and police standing with machine guns, because the question you ask at that point is really, I shouldn't be here.
Thank you. Well, I hope that was an interesting panel for you. I need to conclude, so please join me in a round of applause for the panelists.